Here's the deal, gang. For all the tax overhaul coverage you have heard, we are still really just at the beginning of this thing. So today, how to know when to start actually paying attention. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 13th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will begin today with a completely serious, although fundamentally unanswerable question. As congressional Republicans keep grinding away on their tax bill, the question is, which tax bill is the tax bill? The full House is planning to vote on its bill this week. The Senate Finance Committee started work on its bill today. President Trump, as you might have heard, weighed in on Twitter this morning with a suggestion or two of his own. There is, in short, a lot going on, and keeping things straight is no easy task. So we got Richard Rubin on the phone. He covers tax policy for The Wall Street Journal. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So is it just me, or is this whole thing getting more complicated the closer we get, in theory, to some kind of resolution of what this bill is going to be?
Well, I think in some ways it's part of the natural legislative process where you've got now two competing bills, the House bill and the Senate bill, and they're both changing. The House bill changing multiple times in committee last week. The Senate bill is headed for a bunch of changes this week. So if there were only one thing and they were working on one thing, maybe you could follow it. That's not where we are.
And now you have the president weighing in this morning in a tweet saying he wants the individual mandate repealed in one of these bills. He also wants changes to the top layer to pay for middle class tax cuts. There's yet a third player.
Yeah. And, you know, the Republicans on the Hill are somewhat wary of that. They, House members, quite clearly recall when they passed a health care bill and he cheered it on and then he called it mean. So they're a little wary of his what he's going to do. It's been relatively quiet on this front while he's been in Asia. And this tweet, this statement before he comes back, just shows exactly what could happen when he returns and finds something he doesn't like and disrupts the process.
You wrote this weekend about the ultimate stated purpose from the Republicans on this thing is to simplify the tax code. Is it going to do that?
Sort of. There are some ways in which this will be simpler. Fewer people will itemize, so you get less tracking of your charitable contributions because you won't get to write them off separately anyway. But there's also a subset of people for whom simplification is actually worse. If you get take the medical expense deduction now for nursing home care or whatever, and you can't get that, well, sure, it's simpler, but you might pay more. And so there's always this trade-off between simplification and who actually bears the tax burden.
Much has been made of the amount to which the federal debt will – the amount by which the federal debt will grow as a result of this bill. Do you, as a guy who studied this for a while, do you put much stock in the this tax cut will pay for itself school of thought that Secretary Mnuchin and others are forwarding?
Tax cuts and tax policy in general can change the size of the economy. Taxes matter. Tax reforms, overhauls, whatever word you want to use, can make the economy more efficient. And that can encourage growth. They can encourage investment. But I would just be wary of any large claims in either direction on this.
What are you looking for in the next, God, it's 72, 96 hours, right, until this thing starts moving forward substantively?
Well, it's a two-ring circus this week. So you've got the which is, you know, less than usual. Look, you've got the – because you get two things – you really do have two things happening. You have the House trying to get 218 votes for their bill, and we'll see whether they'll need any substantive changes to get there. It doesn't look like it at this point. And then you have the Senate Finance Committee working on its version, and they'll be in a committee markup all week. Really what we have going on are the House and Senate each trying to solve their own vote-counting problems.
Right.
And then if they get there, to then try and solve each other's vote counting problems.
Well, to that problem of the twain eventually having to meet on this thing, is there a sense, do you have a sense from talking to people on the Hill and on these committees of which House's version, the House or the Senate, might wind up being closer to what finally winds up being passed? That's a complicated question, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, whichever House the person is that you're talking to, they think their version will prevail. And look, there's some real fundamental disconnects here. The House has had to continue to allow a $10,000 property tax deduction to get enough votes from lawmakers from New York and New Jersey to get this thing to pass. The Senate uses the money from repealing that to pay for other tax cuts. You hear people sometimes saying, oh, they're just doing tax cuts, and they're not. There's some significant structural changes to the tax system that they're putting in here that are more than just taking $1.5 trillion in tax cuts and spreading it around. But they've definitely been moving in the direction from overhaul toward cuts along a continuum over the past year or so.
Right. Richard Rubin, he is the U.S. tax policy reporter at the Wall Street Journal, writing on this for weeks and weeks and months and months, and it's all good
years.
Stuff. Years. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
There is a question about this tax bill at the way macroeconomic policy level that we've touched on a little bit, but which hasn't gotten all that much attention. What it's going to mean if, as is currently planned, these tax cuts add $1.5 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years. The Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania has a new study out on that topic. It says the economy is going to grow in the short run, but that the extra debt load would end up dragging economic growth down in the long run, so much so that in a couple of decades, the economy might be right back where it would have been without any tax cut at all. That all that public debt, and this is the phrase the economists use, all that public debt would have crowded out private investment. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains what's up with that.
Have you ever cooked dinner for someone and then gotten a call from them last minute being like,
I was wondering if I could invite my friend.
And then you're like, and then the friend comes.
This is so good. I'm going to have more of this.
And there's not enough food for everyone. That's the crowding out effect. The unwanted friend of a friend is the government. Think of the food you cooked as all the investment money available in the country. Normally, it would go to stocks and bonds and real estate. And then the government shows up and says, hi, I'm in debt. Give me some of that investment. It starts selling more bonds. And to get people to buy them, it starts offering higher interest rates.
Some of that pool of savings then goes to purchase those bonds rather than flowing to real investment in productive equipment for the economy.
Benjamin Page is with the Tax Policy Center. He says that bids up interest rates for businesses, too, and they borrow less.
On net, you have lower investment in the end.
The result is a long, slow break on economic growth. Kent Smetters is faculty director of the Penn Wharton budget model. His group's calculations say the crowding out effect will cancel out any stimulus from the tax cuts.
By 2040, we're expecting GDP to basically return back to its level as under current law.
Now, not everyone believes this crowding out effect will happen. Gavin Eakins with the Tax Foundation says tax cuts will get companies to save more and draw foreign money in. Together, that can fill in any gaps.
There's a lot of these international flows that are coming into the United States.
Without the crowding out effect, Eakins calculates a much higher stimulus from the tax cuts. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, terrible start, break even finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the Marketplace desk, if presidential tweets are, in fact, official White House policy announcements, this item today. President Trump tweeted out that he is going to nominate Alex Azar to be the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. It's going to be a return trip to the government for Azar. He was Deputy Secretary of HHS in the George W. Bush administration. Then he took a break for a top job at Eli Lilly, the big drug company, a key participant in the American healthcare marketplace. That swinging back and forth between the public and private sectors has become a key part of our regulatory framework in this country. And super important caveat here, it did not start with the Trump administration, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
It's known as the revolving door. You work in government for a while, then go to work for the industry you used to regulate, then sometimes you go back to government. There have been concerns about it ever since the days of, yes, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was accused of pushing policies that would benefit his financial interests, says Matthew Mitchell, an economist at the Mercatus Center. He says the revolving door started swinging in the 1800s.
The first federal regulatory body was the Interstate Commerce Commission. They had, you know, former railway men that were working there.
As the government regulated more, industry wanted people with government experience to help companies interpret regulations and lobby their former colleagues. And the government wanted industry experience. Susan Dudley directs the Regulatory Studies Center at George Washington University.
Private sector experience is essential in government because if you don't have it, you get policies that don't reflect the realities of the marketplace.
But Robert Weissman, head of Public Citizen, says the revolving door is showing no signs of slowing down under the current administration. He says Public Citizen found that 70% of President Trump's early appointees for top positions came from the corporate world, a percentage Weissman says it's much higher than average.
Under the Trump administration, it's a pure open door because we're seeing hordes of industry insiders going into government regulatory positions.
Weissman worries these new government appointees will be too sympathetic toward the companies they're regulating. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There were huge, huge changes at the original American industrial conglomerate today. John Flannery, the CEO of General Electric, announced a restructuring plan that Flannery said will make GE, quote, a smaller business, a simpler business, end of quote. Also getting smaller, by the way, the dividend that GE pays shareholders, which is going to be cut in half. Sounds alarming, yes, if you or your retirement fund owns GE, but Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has some context on that.
Say you own GE stock today, and the company pays its dividend today. You'd get 24 cents for every share. On 1,000 shares, you get $240 cash for nothing but holding the stock. The share price can go up or down. You're still going to get 24 cents a share. That makes high-dividend stocks like GE especially popular with one group, says Alex Dietz of Private Asset Management.
It's typically your older investors, your retirees, and you know, the 50 to 80s range.
That steady cash flow is why dividend investing is sometimes called income investing. It's generally a safer sort of bet than so-called growth investing, where you're betting a share price will go up and up and up. GE has been a solid income investment for decades.
The stock has been passed on from generation to generation, and people have just been comfortable with the name.
But Deet says GE's not the company it used to be. Cash flow and other problems are forcing it to cut that dividend in half, from 24 to 12 cents a share. Stephen Gattuso, who teaches finance at Canisius College, says that'll send some shareholders running, but it's not all bad. GE can do other things with the money.
Instead of paying it out to their investors, they're redeploying use of that cash to transform the business into something more profitable.
Gattuso calls this a one-off situation, specific to GE's particular problems. Dividend investing still works. Besides, GE has paid a much higher dividend than its peers in recent years. With this dividend cut, it's just going from excellent to pretty good. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
One way to think about insurance is as an indicator of risk tolerance, right? How much you think you need protection against this or that unpleasant thing happening. It seems, according to the U.S. Travel Insurance Association, we are wanting more protection against bad things happening to our travel plans. Travel insurance spending, the group says, is up almost 20% the past couple of years. Ashley Montite has that one.
Humphrey Ralston and his wife have traveled a lot in the last few decades. He's from England. She's from Maine. Most of their trips have been to visit family here and abroad. They've never bought travel insurance.
We've never really discussed it, never felt the need to discuss it. You know, travel for us has been pretty routine.
Until now. They're both in their 60s and retired, and next spring they're planning a big, expensive trip to Israel and Jordan, the first vacation they've taken, just the two of them, since their honeymoon in 1989. This time they're taking out insurance.
There's potential terrorism, there's potential conflict on a greater scale. And if you combine that with the fact that both of us have parents, you know, into their 90s, you know, not in the best of health, there's always a chance that while we're on vacation or just as about we're going to go on vacation, something terrible could happen.
Their policy will reimburse them if they cancel their trip or have to head home early. It also covers medical evacuation, even search and rescue if they get lost in the desert. It's costing them more than $1,000. That's because insurance is calculated as a percentage of the trip cost, usually between 4 and 8%. And the older you are, the pricier the insurance. Dan Durazzo is communications director for Allianz Global Assistance. He says there's good reason more people are paying up.
We think that's because the world has become a very unpredictable place.
Growing terrorism in Europe is spooking American travelers into buying insurance. But fires and hurricanes in the U.S. are also playing a part.
For Irma and Maria, we saw a lot of people canceling their trips because they couldn't travel to their destination in either Florida or the Caribbean.
His company received 14,000 claims from Irma alone, partly because Orlando, a huge tourist destination, was in the path of the storm. And he says they expect to pay most of them. Those people had the foresight to buy insurance ahead of hurricane season. But if you wait too long, you'll have a problem, says Stan Stanberg. He's co-founder of TravelInsurance.com, an insurance comparison site.
One has to purchase the insurance before a storm is named in order to be able to get coverage.
Still, natural disasters put future travelers on guard. In the days after Hurricane Irma became a Category 5 storm in September, insurance purchases on Stanberg's site shot up. But he says it's not just specific events that are fueling sales. It's demographics, too. Lately, millennial travelers have been the fastest growing group of insurance buyers on the site. He says they'll often buy extra protection for action-packed getaways.
Some plans will actually provide what's called hazardous sports coverage or adventure travel coverage. So we're seeing that as a trend in the industry as well.
And there are more baby boomers, like first-time insurance buyer Humphrey Ralston. He and his wife want to tick experiences off their bucket list while they're energetic and healthy.
I can't wait. I mean, I haven't been to Israel since 1976.
When he worked on a kibbutz in the desert and slept in a wooden hut. This time, the accommodations will be a lot more stylish, and his investment is covered. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up.
One colleague said once, come on, let's go to the Deutsche Bank and eat something.
I'll make a deposit, bitte, and how about the schnitzel? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 17 points today, less than a 10%, 23,439 on the blue chips. NASDAQ up 6, about a 10%, 67.57. The S&P 500 up 2 points, about a 10%, 25.84. Talk about General Electric cutting its dividend in half. Investors were not happy with that. GE shares fell 7% on the news. Also, the company lowered earnings targets for 2018 and said the streamlining and restructuring operations are going to take, quote, years to accomplish. Board of directors at chipmaker Qualcomm unanimously rejected an unsolicited $105 billion takeover offer from rival Broadcom. Can you say hostile bid a-coming? Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In the first half of this year, January through June, more than 1,000 bank branch offices in this country were closed. Since the financial crisis, 10,000 have closed and all. We just don't need them as much because a whole lot of banking has moved to our phones and our computers. But that's a whole lot of office space looking for something to do. Maybe something less bank-like. They're having the same problem in Germany, where Claire Tennisgetter found this report.
A typical German bank branch looks a lot like an American branch, with tellers behind desks, customers lined up, ATMs up front. But not this one.
A bank? I don't think so. I'm just looking for drink coffee.
That's Sylvie Katvi. She just came into this experimental Deutsche Bank branch in downtown Berlin and thought the bank was a cafe. And she's not the only one who isn't using the bank for, you know, banking. Carsten Kamholz works in an office across the street from the bank.
I don't go here to do some banking. I just go here sometimes to have my lunch.
Yes, we're in Germany, so the culture is different. But Carsten confirms that even in Germany, it's not normal to eat lunch in a bank.
One colleague said once, come on, let's go to the Deutsche Bank and eat something. And I was looking at him like, okay, what? And then we came here and I realized that you can really have good food here. And then I had a look around, and I'm quite fascinated by the whole thing.
This bank is huge, about 14,000 square feet. Years ago, the space was actually a showroom for cars. But today, cars have been replaced by minimalist couches and chairs. Along with the cafe, there's a co-working space with a giant wall of plants and a short-term babysitting area decorated with a big plush owl. Nothing about this is typical for a bank. And that's the point.
This is how we try to attract more people to come to a Deutsche Bank branch.
That's Stefan Dietzel, a manager here at Deutsche Bank. He's young, energetic, friendly. Stefan tells me this branch was remodeled last year, and he still remembers the old space.
You see a separate room, which was a former office. By the way, it was my office. Now it's a kids' corner.
Now customers who actually want to open an account, plan for retirement, or get a mortgage can meet with Stefan at a shared table or in a private room. which also has a sleek design.
If you just push one button, you can frost the windows so to have complete privacy.
This branch is actually designed to be a lab to test new bank features. It's called Cartier Zukunft, or Branch of the Future. So if the cafe feature is a success, they'll build cafes in more Deutsche Bank branches across Germany. Oh, and there's one more thing.
We are a cashless branch, so it's not possible to withdraw money.
Although, if you have to have cash, there are some ATMs outside. And this bank shape-shifting isn't unique to Germany. You can already get financial advice via video chat at a bank in Chicago, organize community meetings at a bank in Portland, or hang out in a cafe at a bank in Boston. And experts are expecting more change. Bank analyst Nancy Bush at NAB Research says in 3 to 5 years, old-style branches will be increasingly rare. One of the reasons?
Millennials, your generation probably, that never want to go in a bank unless they absolutely have to.
Yes, I'm a millennial, and I actually never go to my bank branch. In fact, my bank is in another state. Back at Deutsche Bank, I asked Stefan Dietzel if all banks will look like Cartier Zukunft in 10 years.
No, I don't think so. But I definitely think that we will see some certain aspects of Cartier Zukunft in the upcoming years at other Deutsche Bank branches.
Want to try something experimental to get this millennial into a bank branch? How about free avocado toast, student loan forgiveness, and puppies? In Berlin, I'm Claire Tennisgetter for Marketplace.
One of the fundamental precepts of this program is that everything has an economic angle. Exhibit A today in a new occasional series, Colors. First up, from a book by Cassia St. Clair called The Secret Lives of Color, is mauve. Not just purple, but the original mauve, super bright and vivid, which comes with some Silicon Valley-esque qualities to it. The story starts not in a garage, but in an attic in London, circa 1856, and a guy named William Perkin. Here is Cassia St. Clair.
What William Perkin was actually searching for was a means to create a synthetic cure for malaria. But one day, while he was in this lab, he found in the bottom of his test tube, rather than a colourless liquid, which is what he would have hoped for, he instead found a bright purple liquid. And I think most scientists might have thrown this away. But instead, he dipped a piece of cloth into this mixture and found that what he had accidentally created was a light and washproof dye in this very vivid, rich purple. Purple has always been quite a difficult and rare colour to get for dyers. But at the time it was created, the idea of a chemical dye that was being produced synthetically in a lab was completely alien to cloth workers. And he actually had a bit of a hard time trying to sell this to them. However, very luckily for him, two women decided that this was their colour. And even more luckily for him, they were the trendsetters of their day. The first was Empress Eugenie, who was the wife of Napoleon III. And the second was Queen Victoria herself. And the colour just took off. Suddenly it was everywhere, and cloth workers were falling over themselves to get hold of this dye that William Perkin had created completely accidentally. And also, this discovery of mauve opened up a sort of a new avenue of chemical research. The whole rainbow was created, you know, using similar methods.
Cassia St. Clair there from her book, The Secret Lives of Color. This final note on the way out today, in which it is entirely possible that Jeff Bezos and Amazon just have too darn much money. There are reports today that even after 12 hours worth of feature films, Amazon Studios is banking on more of an appetite from Lord of the Rings fans. The company is said to have spent $250 million on the television series rights for the J.R.R. Tolkien story, just the rights. More accomplished Hollywood watchers than I point out that that's before development and that production costs could hit $150 million a season. I should note here for the record and to prove my what-do-I-know-ness that the movies grossed almost $3 billion worldwide. And we are out of here. The Dow up 17 today, less than a tenth percent. The Nasdaq rose 6 points, about a tenth. S&P 500 up 2 points, just about a tenth percent there as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Haley Hirschman, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.